Welcome to the OMR podcast. Every once in a while we put out a new episode, and it's that time again. Our friend, a serial founder from Hamburg, Germany, Eric Siegmann, he spoke to Nate Silver. Nate Silver, obviously one of the biggest names in data analysis, in number crunching, the founder of 538. Him and Eric, they spoke during the OMR festival a couple of weeks ago and discussed misconceptions between predicting and forecasting, sports and politics, and why Nate's greatest failure in 2016 was not even a failure. Enjoy!
All right. Live from the OMR 18 Rockstars Festival. It's a great pleasure to have you here, Nate Silver.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's great. Thank you. You just came off the stage. I was really humbled to have the opportunity to have this little podcast session with you. You've been acclaimed as the Galileo of the number crunchers, or the new Oracle of Delphi. How just recently arrived at Hamburg? Did you have an impression on the OMR 18 festival?
Because I feel like I'm just kind of fresh off the boat, so to speak. People seem really smart, and like I'm impressed, and like it's quite visually impressive. People might not know if they're not here, but like there's a lot going on. It's like banging and like clanging, and like there's a lot of sponsorships, and so it's kind of in your face, very much. Right. You know, it's not subtle.
It sure is. It sure isn't. You're very demanded speaker, and you have many public appearances in TV, on the stage and off the stage. And of course, you are not only data scientist, but also a journalist, if I may say so. Could you say any difference of your observations speaking in Europe or in Germany specifically compared to the US?
I mean, I think people in some ways here ask different questions about data security and data privacy that we're starting to ask now in the US, but have been asked in Europe for a longer period of time. I think people here are a little bit more skeptical about kind of large corporations and kind of their role. I mean, less so in Germany than other parts of Europe. I mean, Germany and America, I think America is quite Germanic in its outlook in some ways, frankly. It's a somewhat different audiences, I think.
All right, let's maybe start with you as a person, as an entrepreneur. Is it right to say that you financed your college with being a very professional poker player?
Yeah, sort of. So that's how I kind of broke out of. So I had a corporate job coming out of college, working as what's called a transfer pricing consultant, which is not very exciting. And eventually began playing poker. There was kind of a poker bubble or poker boom during the 2000s, and that enabled me to make a fair amount of income and quit, and eventually got bored of poker. I started losing, went from winning to losing. And before I lost all the money I had won, found a new passion, which was what we call data journalism. So I founded a site called 538. 538 is named after the Electoral College, which is the number of electoral votes we have in the United States.
Oh, that explains.
It's a bit obscure. But you know, we have an audience that likes the obscure, and had no idea that that would find a big market. But like, people were interested in a more data-oriented perspective on American politics, because there was so much punditry and there was so much stuff that was like not evidence-driven. You know, assertions that were based on inside gossip that didn't really hold up that well, and so that proved to be like surprisingly popular. We of course have had like a number of pretty remarkable and interesting elections in the United States. So I founded 538 in 2008, which was the election where we had, first of all, Hillary Clinton against Barack Obama in the primary, and then Obama became president, first African-American president in the United States. And so it was a moment when and Obama's team, of course, was also quite data-driven in their outlook toward campaigning. So it was kind of being in the right place at the right time.
What is it fair to say that the 2008 election was kind of the starting point of data-driven campaigning and prediction as well? Like a new generation of polling and predicting?
So it's not quite fair. I think it's halfway true. You know, under George Bush, Karl Rove was his campaign guru, and they were fairly data driven. I mean, I think 2008 was a change for media coverage, where media there had often been like lots of misunderstanding of polls and margins of error and probabilities and a lot of mischaracterization. So it kind of hit the mainstream media in 2008. But campaigns have always been fairly data driven. I mean, you're trying to, the problem is you're trying to like reach a fairly small segment of swing voters in the United States. I mean, the United States is not like Germany where we have, where there are six or seven parties, right? It's like there are two major parties. People are very polarized between the parties. And so only 10% of the country are really swing voters. And of those 10%, they only matter in a few states that are swing states because of the Electoral College. Yeah. So therefore, you're trying to find kind of needles in haystacks. I'm not sure if that idiom translates here, but you're trying to find people who are few and far between. And so therefore, it kind of necessitates a more potentially data-driven approach.
Yeah. Maybe it's just the tipping point, the 2008 election, because, well, from a European perspective, that was the first election or post-election, that was the first time when those data scientists of the equivalent of the teams toured throughout Europe afterwards. Yeah. And also you became some kind of at least famous in Europe as well, because you and your company predicted 49 of 50 states accurately.
Yeah.
So that was also some kind of boost of
I think it all got kind of tied together in people's minds, right? Yeah. And this is also a time when, like, I mean, in sports, there was also a lot of excitement over statistics in sports.
Yeah.
You know, the Boston Red Sox had won the World Series after many years of not doing so in 2004, and so that was like that was quite exciting to people, and they had taken a very statistically oriented approach. And so, you know, it's kind of when like statistical analysis hit the mainstream is one way to put it.
All right.
Even though there'd always been some of it in campaigns in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we enter into that area that you, of course, you're not only actively researching and also writing and publishing regarding politics, but also regarding sports. So just to continue that road and also maybe to explain what 538 does from after the 2008 election, you even improved your success with the 2012 election and having 50 of 50 states,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, although I should say, I don't think that's the right way to measure our forecasts.
Yeah.
Because we make forecasts that are probabilistic.
Yeah.
Right. And so we think the right way to measure things is if you say something has an 80% likelihood of occurring, then over the long run, does it occur about 80% of the time?
Yeah.
And so therefore, you know, within that 49 of 50 or 50 out of 50, you have some calls that are basically 50-50, you know. And then so you shouldn't get really either credit or blame for that. Because what we're doing is not prediction. Prediction's bullshit. Forecasting is what we're doing. And forecasting is probabilistic. And forecasting is about preparing one for risk and uncertainty.
Yeah, maybe you could elaborate on the very, very important difference between predicting and forecasting.
So forecasting, by the way, I think is a Germanic root word, and so it's, you know, and whereas predict is like Roman or Latin, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
So there's some cultural differences here. But yeah, you know, forecasting, like I said, number one, a forecast is probabilistic, but it, literally the root word, like forecast, it means like to prepare for uncertain conditions. If I don't, you know, I'm not an etymologist, but like it kind of goes back to like, whereas prediction means like to declare or to say, there is a Latin root word.
Yep.
And so they like literally have, they're kind of different concepts that get conflated, but like, but to me, the world is not a terribly predictable place. But if you're rigorous, including the use of data, in analyzing the world, then you can outline a blueprint of possibilities and put weights on those possibilities and probabilities on those possibilities that over the long run are reasonably accurate. And so that's the goal, actually. It's not to predict, because there's, I mean, you know, it's about kind of saying, what can we measure and how much uncertainty is there?
Right. Coming back to the 2012 elections, and I am also interested in understanding your entrepreneurial development. So what was the impact on 538 after 2012?
I mean, there was a lot of excitement around it, obviously, and you know, 538 had previously been start out independent. In 2012, we were licensed by the New York Times. Yeah. And then 2013, my contract with the New York Times expired, and we wanted to do something that was bigger. And so we went from having like two or three people to what we have now, which is a team of about two or three dozen people, so around 30 people. You know, combining, I had previously spent before 538, had done a lot of work in sports.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we now are employed by ESPN, which is a big sports programming network.
You sold your company to ESPN in which year?
In 2013.
All right.
2014. Yeah. Take that back. Yeah. And have been there for 4 years and change now.
Yeah.
Or 2013. Yeah. So yeah, it was like it's been almost 5 years.
All right.
And now we're looking forward toward our next step, which is another discussion. But
all right.
Yeah.
Are you? Do you want to talk about the next step?
I'm happy to. I mean, so we're kind of in the phase where we have a couple of different offers for 538, and some of this has been reported publicly, and I still own part of it, and ESPN yeah. has owned part of it, so we're kind of yeah. working cooperatively to figure out what the best next step is.
All right.
Yeah. It's stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Phone calls to make, you know, once people in America wake up.
Yeah,
unfortunately, it can't be a pure vacation for me. I have phone calls to make later. So
yeah, maybe that's very interesting. Maybe we'll talk about that issue a little later. But it is. I think it's very like you say. Your audience likes the obscure, the mixture of politics and sports was within your first DNA of 538. What does politics and sports do have in common?
I mean, what they have in common is that you can apply statistical modeling to understand both of them better. I mean, they're more different than they are alike in some ways. Sports is a lot easier to predict in some sense, in the sense that like sports have a defined set of rules. So they're closed systems, they don't change that much over time. Yes, they evolve. I'm a basketball fan. Basketball, if you watch an NBA game today, is much different than if you watch a game 30 years ago or something. But like the rules and the structure stay the same. And so that makes them kind of easier to model. Politics, there are some things that are sports-like. You know, so the Electoral College in the United States abides by a certain set of rules, are not open-ended, and so although the parties change and the candidates change, there's some degree of predictability there. But kind of broader political trends, that's not my job to forecast, I mean, wouldn't really try to forecast, right? What we're saying is, like, if we have polling data and other types of data, like economic data, then at short time horizons, so anywhere from a day to 6 months in advance of election, and we can build a forecast and say, how do those polls translate into the probability of each party winning? That doesn't mean, though, that politics is inherently a predictable enterprise, that you would necessarily have predicted the rise of nationalism, for example, in Europe, the United States. We can debate whether that's now become over-predicted or not. But, yeah. So I'm not like someone who's trying to predict broad political currents. I'm saying I'm trying to, like, define a problem which is a solvable problem, right? To me, the problem of, like, we want to take an empirical measure of how accurate polls really are so we can distinguish between when a candidate has a 99% chance versus a 70% chance versus a 50% chance. We can do that. That's a solvable problem. And in sports, like, a lot of problems are solvable in that sense. It doesn't mean we know who's going to win the game, but we can put kind of rough probabilities around things, right? You know, around which team's most likely to win the World Cup, for example.
Yeah. Don't they also have in common, politics and sports, that the possibilities and the tools we can use today in data science are maybe underutilized by reporters, journalists, by society in general?
For sure. I mean, although it's changed a lot in sports in the United States, and I'm not sure about the experience over in Europe as much.
And soccer as well.
Yeah. In the U.S., kind of sports now are quite analytically driven, and people are pretty smart about it.
Yeah.
In politics, you definitely have a clash where political journalists are not very data literate.
Yeah.
And they see a more analytical approach, frankly, as undermining their approach, which is based on inside information and gossip,
yeah,
sort of. And so there really is like a culture clash in politics between what we're trying to do and other political journalists. There's not that in sports. In sports, kind of everyone gets along a lot better, and everyone realizes, hey, in sports you have a very well-defined bottom line. It's like, yeah, who wins,
yeah,
right? And so that tends to focus things a little bit more.
Yeah.
And you have games played, you know, every few days.
Yeah.
In politics, you have one election every 4 years, and so you can be wrong about something, and that can persist for a long time.
Yeah, so it might be, is it fair to say that in sports it's easier to predict and also relatively easy to control the results and the root cause?
It's easy. I mean, sports is like the Platonic ideal of, like, it's easy to determine cause and effect. Again, it's, yeah, a closed system. A limited, yeah, number of things can happen on a soccer pitch, right? It's still amazing and wonderful. It can be beautiful, but, like, it's like, you know, it makes it easier to, like, build a model for.
Yeah. Also, the number of variables are limited.
It's a finite number of variables.
Yeah.
And things are easily testable because, again, you can, like, have a theory in sports, and if you're right or wrong, then that can be borne out over the course of a few games,
yep,
or a few seasons at most. In politics, you might have a strategy, but you only have one election, like I said, every 4 years, and so it can take a long time.
Yeah. Nate, I'm afraid we need to have to touch that issue of the 2016 elections.
Yeah.
What went wrong?
Nothing went wrong. But this is why probability is important.
Yeah.
Where our forecast said that Trump had about a 30% chance of winning.
Yeah.
To us, that's really valuable information, because if you had read the New York Times or if you looked at other forecasts, they would say that it was almost impossible for Trump to,
yeah,
win.
Yeah.
And so if you understand what we're doing, then that's highly valuable information to say that relative to what people are assuming, that Trump was a lot more likely to win than people may have thought.
Yeah.
And the reason for that have to do with careful and more rigorous analysis of data. So number one, we have 50 states in the United States that all have votes in the Electoral College. Those states are not independent from one another. That if Trump beats his polls in one state, he's going to also beat his polls in other states.
Yep.
Number two, there were a high number of undecided voters, meaning 15 or 20% of the country went into the campaign in the last week not knowing who they're going to vote for. It's not the job of a poll to determine for a voter who says she's undecided who to vote for. So I think there's a lot of bullshit around analysis of 2016, that the polls pointed toward a close race that either candidate could win.
Yep.
And that's what happened. The polls were actually about as accurate in 2016 as they had been historically. So I think people misinterpreted that, and journalists in the United States have their own biases,
yep,
and were so sure that Clinton would win that color their interpretation of the data, and they thought they were being objective. If you look at the data rigorously, that was a close and competitive election, and the Trump result was not that surprising. The same thing happened with Brexit, where you,
yep,
had a lot of journalists in the United Kingdom who ignored that the polls actually showed Brexit to be almost 50-50 in the polls.
Yep.
And so they were really shocked. That reflects, yep, their biases and their misunderstanding of data.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, because I took the time and just preparing this podcast, and I took all the video footage you gave, because you've been a really public figure. Well, you are a public figure, but a very popular public figure during this election. And even some, I think last week before the actual elections, you've been talking, I think it was on CNN, regarding the margin of error. And I had the feeling that you had a hard time to explain to journalists what a margin of error meant,
yeah,
in polling.
Yeah, look, so there are various reasons why there's a margin of error in polling. One being that a poll might ask 600 people or 1,000 people instead of the whole country, and so you have random sampling error. You also have the fact that some people don't decide until they're in the voting booth, so you have error introduced by undecided voters. And you have the fact that, like, polls actually do not reach a perfectly random sample. They desire to, but some people are more likely to respond to polls than others, and so therefore polls can have biases in a statistical sense that are larger than the theoretical margins of error. And so, you know, historically polls in the US are off by an average of about 3 points.
Yep.
On average about 3 points, which means the margin of error is about plus or minus 6 points.
Yeah.
And so therefore, when Clinton led by 3 or 4 points in the popular vote, also she did win the popular vote, but to use that as an example, that was not a safe lead. And when she was ahead by 2 points or 3 points or 4 points in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, ahead by maybe a point, if anything, in Florida, none of those outcomes were really even outside the margin of error. So it's not even like, because there are times when you're outside the margin of error, but like if you had actually understood that polling is a pretty good tool, but that a 2 or 3 point race in the US, and our polls are better than some places, better than the UK, but a 2 or 3 point race is either way going to go to either candidate fairly often. You also saw in the U.S. the race shifted over the last week of the campaign. So Clinton had had a lead that was about 6 or 7 points as of mid-October. But then you had the FBI director come out with a statement, hey, we're reopening the Clinton investigation. Yeah. You had WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
You had, you know, and the Clinton campaign made mistakes too. I mean, the states they campaigned in were not the states they should have been campaigning in.
So many uncertainties during that election.
Yeah, but it's not the best example to use of the case where the data was way off, because like if you have a candidate who's ahead by 2 points and the margin of error is 5 points, then that candidate's going to lose by 2 or 3 points fairly often. And it's also important to note that Trump's win was very narrow. He lost the popular vote and he won the key states by half a point to a point.
Yeah.
If Trump had won by 10 points, that's a different question. Then that's a question of, oh my gosh, the polls were way, way off.
Yes.
A miss outside the margin of error. Are these models accounting for that possibility properly? But like Trump narrowly winning when Clinton was narrowly ahead and there's a large margin of error is just not very surprising.
Yeah.
The whole bigger picture from a macro level, Trump becoming president might be more surprising, right?
Yes.
But if you take the name off the polls, which is kind of what we're trying to do, right? In our model, it's like Democrat or Republican, and we don't come to any preconception based on whether it's Trump. So if you had had a different, more traditional Republican, I think people would have been more rational about the fact that, oh my gosh, this race has really, really tightened up in the last week of the campaign. Clinton's ahead, but barely.
Yeah.
You'd bet on her. But if you got 2-1 or 3-1 on Trump odds, then much, much stranger things have happened than a candidate who's only slightly behind in the polls winning under those circumstances.
Yeah, all right. Like you mentioned that there have been biases on the journalist side. What is your tool to get your message across to be comprehensive but also relevant and precise in your messages?
I mean, it's partly having an ongoing dialogue with readers, right? We do better in longer format stuff. So if we, you know, we have a podcast, for example, 538 right. podcast, and like, you know, to be able to talk to people for 45 minutes or an hour at a time is valuable. To be able to have a dialogue with readers where you're writing about the election every day and not just weighing in. And so in some sense, you know, our enemy is like the kind of TV soundbite where people lose the context. Because I understand that like when you present numbers to people without the context, then you're subject to all sorts of misconceptions, because people have, you know, numbers trigger weird things in people's brains and different perceptions, right? So if I say Clinton has a 70% chance of winning and Trump has a 30% chance, then that means different things to different people. Some people might say 70%, that sounds really good, right? That's not what's meant by that. Yeah. You know, 30% likelihood of an event that would change American history or world history. You know, even a 5% chance would be something that one would want to consider carefully. But people don't always, people interpret numbers in different ways. So having a dialogue with readers in the form of written articles and podcasts and stories you're able to tell is pretty important too.
Well, but is there a chance? I think the majority of your TV statements in large media outlets was something like 90 seconds. How do you get your message across within 19 seconds.
Well, maybe you don't. You know, I mean, I feel like I probably do less TV than I used to because I think it's extremely important kind of how you frame your message.
Absolutely.
And I don't believe that, like, but I also established, so I have, like, the privilege, I guess, of, like, kind of picking and choosing a little bit. But, like, I don't necessarily want to go on TV and have 90 seconds, right? I want someone to seek out me and that I want to kind of present the information with the context that I know needs to be included to aid understanding and not misunderstanding. If you're going to have 90 seconds and you need to have, like, a host or a producer who's done homework and who gets you, right?
Yeah.
But TV is kind of a challenging medium, I think. In the narrow question of, like, expressing uncertainty in election forecasts, it'll now be easier in the United States because we can just say, hey, remember Trump.
Yeah.
You know, remember, Clinton was a little bit ahead, but not that far ahead, and we said there was a 30% chance, so be careful. So, like, in that narrow sense, like, Trump will make it easier now for people to understand the difference between a candidate who's ahead and a candidate who's a sure thing.
Yep.
But, you know, but not every communications tool is equally adept to have a message that requires, like, a little bit of nuance and complexity.
In the last 2.5 years, we learned what fake news are, and we learned well that even a new dimension of interpretation and being biased. So it's for the large masses, is getting tougher and tougher, and of course for the journalists as well. And we just recently had that reissue of the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Yeah.
You just recently tweeted that campaigning in that case couldn't really move the needle. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, look, the Clinton campaign had invested like 4 or 5 times more money than the Trump campaign. And it didn't do them much good, obviously, right?
Yes.
Both in terms of how they allocated resources, but, like, in terms of, like, they didn't persuade very many swing voters. In fact, most swing voters actually went to Trump. It's kind of circular, but, like, you know, it's probably because in the U.S., I mean, campaigns are such a big media phenomenon where advertising is not as powerful as what we call earned media. So if you get kind of the way the press covers a campaign is more important, even with all the money spent on advertising. But also, people are very partisan in the U.S., and so there aren't that many swing voters necessarily. But yeah, I mean, people don't want to admit that, like, campaigns don't make all that much difference in a world of mass communication.
It's a probably unpopular message. I think I...
Well,
let me be careful, but for
national local campaigns, sure, then campaigning matters. But national campaigns, less so.
Do you think that micro-targeting, no matter what the quality and the sources of data might have been, do you think that micro-targeting could really affect the outcome of a presidential campaign election?
Maybe at the margin. I mean, it might swing at 1% of the vote or something. Again, this isn't a presidential general election campaign. In, like, an obscure race for the U.S. House of Representatives, it could be a lot more important. But, like, people are mostly making decisions, presidential campaigns, based on information they hear from the media and information they hear from their friends and their peer groups. And so the campaigns just don't have that much of the ability to influence relative to the messages that people are seeing and hearing every day. And in the U.S., the fact that, like, during the Republican primary, where you had 16 or 17 candidates and Trump was on TV constantly, like, to buy up, I mean, he was on CNN as much as all the other candidates combined.
Yeah.
To buy that type of airtime would have cost billions and billions of dollars, you know, and so media in the U.S. context is more important than what the campaigns do.
Yeah. Coming, in the online marketing ecosystem, We've been discussing this for the last 2 years, whether micro-targeting or even psychographically gained profiles can really have such an impact. There, of course, there's no question that they might have an impact, but to what extent micro-targeting might change a decision, whether it's an election or a buying behavior or whatever. Especially if the nature of a campaign is that it's for both parties, is beside the budget, it's an even level playing field. So so there is no, there's a symmetry of tools, maybe a difference in buying power, but we've been in the Cambridge Analytica case, it was a question of data science, and as you said, it's rather a big salesman job, but not a real analytical job. Is that correct to say?
Yeah, I mean, there was not much demonstration that their psychographics actually translated into persuading voters. And by the way, the Ted Cruz campaign used them before Trump, and the Cruz campaign lost to Trump and wound up using Cambridge Analytica less and less. And the Trump campaign did not use Cambridge Analytica particularly heavily toward the end of the campaign. They had their own data scientists and data gurus working for the campaign. And so, so to me, it's a little ironic that Cambridge Analytica, which is not the smartest firm, and I think kind of, you know, it's just kind of, they're good at selling themselves and kind of putting the sheen of like data-driven campaigning on themselves. But to me, it's like a little bit of a overblown scandal, I guess. I also think that like it's good that we have more scrutiny of Facebook and the role of, you know, of data security. So I think it's like a good conversation that we're having for like slightly the wrong reason. Which is still a good conversation, but
yeah. But how is your take on how journalists or media in general did reflect to that Cambridge Analytica scandal? One thing, of course, there the second wave. First wave was initiated in Europe by a Swiss journalist. Second wave, well, it was this whistleblower thing with the Observer and the New York. The New Yorker or New York Times?
New York Times. There's been lots of good work on it. Yeah.
Do you think that there's a fair or exact coverage of the actual root causes of the scandal?
I think people overrate how much impact Cambridge Analytica had, and I think they overrate how sophisticated what they was doing. And there's also like, you know, collecting various information sources on someone and trying to give them a score for their propensity to vote for one candidate or another, it's not that different than what campaigns have been doing for a long time than what the Obama campaign did, for example. And so I think there is a tendency to, because Trump did it or because some right-wing candidate in another part of the world did it, right, then the same techniques that were praised when Obama did it, similar techniques are criticized when a right-wing candidate does it. So I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy or inconsistency there. And by the way, the truth is that maybe it should have been criticized when Obama did it. Not because it wasn't effective, but because Obama was a lot more effective than Cambridge Analytica. But because, like, you know, you're kind of invading people's privacy and collecting data on things. People don't know they're leaving a data trail when they subscribe to a magazine or when they use their credit card to purchase something or when they're online, obviously. And Obama, you know, was very smart about like scraping together information in different ways and using it to kind of correlate and predict voter behavior. Cambridge Analytica, I think, had this personality profile thing that didn't really add that much value, but it was a good marketing gimmick.
Yeah.
Obviously, Facebook, it's a bit shocking that that it was easy enough to get access not just to opt-in data, but to your friends' data. I mean, that was a pretty big mistake that Facebook's going to be facing for a long time.
Yeah.
But that has more to do with Facebook than Cambridge Analytica, really. You know, to me, I wish that people just edited Cambridge Analytica out of the story. I think that's like a red herring that people like to use because it was, you know, Trump aligned. Talk about Facebook and Facebook's data security issues. Also the effect that like Facebook's newsfeed algorithm has on the news that people see and the effects that has potentially. But to me, that's the more interesting story. Less of a scandal again and more of a story about the fact that, look, as a very rough approximation, Facebook probably serves up 25% of the news content that people feel or yeah. see in the United States. So that 25% is now determined by algorithms designed by coders in Silicon Valley, as opposed to editors who decide what's on a broadcast or what appears in a newspaper. You can argue positively or negatively for that, right? You can say, okay, maybe I don't want someone to edit out the content I see, but like that's a big change where you displace who controls 25% of the delivery of media content. That's a huge effect on the way that people kind of perceive politics in the world.
But isn't that a paradigm shift, which is tied to the shift from broadcast media like TV to digital marketing itself?
Yeah, but I do think different digital platforms. I mean, we run a publication, and like the traffic you get from Facebook is very different than what you get from Twitter, and both of those are very different than what you get from Google. Let alone smaller communities, Reddit or whatnot. People tend to lump together all different forms of electronic media or all different social media, and the characteristics of the platform are a big deal and like quite different from one another. So I hate when people use the term social media. If you're talking about Facebook, say Facebook. If you're talking about Twitter,
as a platform,
say yeah. Twitter. But they're not particularly good analogies to one another.
Yeah. All right. For the next election, is data science making the difference? Is a better data science team really able to have an influence on the question who's going to be the next president of the United States?
I think at the early stage, I mean, you're going to have in the Democratic race probably a primary featuring 15 or 20 candidates. And so in that environment, then, yeah, turning out your voters is incredibly important. So the early stage, it'll matter.
Yeah.
The late stage, when Democrats pick their candidate, and whether it's Trump or someone else, right, I mean, you might as well do it. You have $1 billion to spend. But again, I'm not saying it's ineffective. I'm just saying that, like, there is so much attention in the United States to politics, and people have such strong views based on media coverage and what their peer groups think, that like, you know, you're fighting against a very, very strong tide, and it doesn't make that much difference.
Yeah.
So you want to wait when the current is neutral, and then even a little push can like change the outcome. That's when it has more influence.
So if I understand you right, is it fair to say that it will or might have an influence on the upper funnel of the selection process, but is less influential on the later stage?
That's
of
a
this?
Good metaphor. Yeah, you can extend the metaphor to say kind of once you get momentum kind of or current flowing in the river or something, then like it becomes quite powerful. But like the upper funnel area, that's where people maybe don't spend enough attention because it's not as sexy, right? And it's a long way away from having like actual results. But the upper kind of initial funnel, and likewise with any type of narrative, right? Like we have found at 538 over the years covering stories where we're involved somehow, stories about us because we're also in business.
Yeah.
You know, the upper funnel is where you can have an influence on perceptions. Once something gets going, you're screwed if the narrative is a way that you think is unfair or unflattering or whatever else, right? But if you kind of change the narrative at the start and are careful about that, then that can have an influence down the road.
Oh, very interesting. Do you have any practical use cases forward-looking? In your very famous book, The Signal and the Noise, you're mentioning many, many examples from different situations, different verticals, and where data science and predictions can make a huge difference. You've been writing about the filter bubble, in bubbles in general, predicting bubbles, etc. Maybe in the area of marketing, online marketing, or in businesses itself, where do you see the next big thing in data science to be applied?
So I'm a little worried in some sense about the obsession with machine learning.
Yeah.
Because I think that, like, you know, again, I'm a traditionalist, where I'm a guy who says data science should be hypothesis driven, where you have a hypothesis, you collect evidence to test it. Ideally, you perform an experiment that involves making a prediction. It's all the scientific method, and then you kind of see how things played out. But you're concerned about causality and the directionality, and you're concerned about the why of things, right?
Yep.
So I worry about the notion that people are like, this obviously kind of unfair stereotype of machine learning, but I worry about people are like, okay, I just need the what, I don't need to worry about the why. I think it's probably not that robust over time, and that it's not very adaptable when conditions change as compared to analyses that are based on, you know, regression analysis and are based on causal inference and are based on like building models that have strong priors that kind of reflect the structure of the real world. So I think there's kind of too much obsession with machine learning, and I think that's going to lead some marketing firms astray.
All right. Well, what do you do to attract skilled people to work with you? You said you employ something like 30 people at 538. So maybe the same question, like how do you attract journalists and CEOs, CMOs to go towards those important issues? How do you make that attractive?
I mean, we mostly hire other journalists. Occasionally, we hire from academic tracks, or we hired someone from Amazon a few years ago. So there are sometimes unconventional approaches that we can take.
How well do you, journalists in general, don't seem well? Maybe a false generalization, but journalists in general are. My understanding is that they're pretty qualitatively driven. How do you attract them to the other side of the world?
So first of all, we only need 30 people out of. You know, there are 100,000 practicing journalists in the United States. You know, second of all, it is pretty generational, where a lot of younger journalists are in programs now where they're taught data science or data journalism.
Yeah.
And or they're taught computer science and they're teach themselves coding. And or, you know, we have a young woman on an interactive team who is an English major and she just taught herself how to code and she's a brilliant coder. So people who are self-taught more. But that is generationally changing, right? Where we, if we're hiring journalists who are five stages into their careers, then probably they didn't grow up with it and that's harder. But like, but the journalists coming out of school or after their first job are much more conversant in the language of data. And so it's becoming an easier problem over time. But yeah, I mean, you have to scrutinize people. You also have to figure out like, not everyone has to do everything, right? You do have teams. And so there can be ways to plug in people with more traditional skill sets into a team that takes a non-traditional approach.
What's the mixture of skills and profiles and capacity of your team?
So about a third of the team are editors, about a third of the team are writers, and about a third of the team are interactive journalists, meaning they build models and they build interactives and data visualization tools.
Yeah.
So and so that ratio is different, right?
Yeah.
Like most journalistic shops have a lot of writers and reporters, a few editors, and like no interactive journalists. And so for us, it's like less about the writing and more about the kind of presentation in different forms of media, including visual presentation and kind of curating and editing that content too. And a lot of stories are very collaborative.
Yeah. You have a very compelling style to of visualization. What's the secret behind that? Do you have a special tool? Is that
a lot of work? And like we have a very skilled team with 9 or 10 people on it, and kind of developing our own style over time. I mean, you know, I think, look, there are basic best practices when it comes to data visualization. One is that they have to be edited in the same sense that anything else has to be edited. And so, you don't want too much information. You don't want too little information either, right? But like, a lot of data visualizations are overly complicated, and they add elements that just kind of confuse the picture. A lot of times people also use graphics and they don't need to, when the graphic would actually be better just explained in a couple of sentences instead. Thinking about interactivity, obviously people browse news content on all different types of platforms now, and so a lot of the work is in having something that will look good on a mobile device and will also look good on a tablet and will also look good on a large screen. And by the way, it's not one size fits all.
Yeah.
Graphics that we make for mobile often have information taken out of them, or where the hierarchy is different, because you can put a ton of information on a small screen and pretend that people can zoom in. That's like not good editing. That's not kind of how people actually consume information naturally on a mobile device.
Yeah.
And so, adopting it for 6 different browsers on several different platforms is where a lot of the hard work comes in.
Yeah, is that one of your more obvious competitive advantage compared to your competitors?
Yeah, I know we have. I mean, there are only a handful of newsrooms in the United States that really have big, robust data visualization teams. And so, you know, and they're mostly the very large newspapers. They're mostly the New York Times and the Washington Post and whatnot. And so, you know, we think our team is right up there competing with those teams, even though, like, we're a much, much, much smaller organization because it's very central to what we do.
Yeah. Is there any secret technical tool you're using?
So it's not my team, right? I hire people to run that team. But, like, but no, we have a stack of tools that we've developed and software that we've kind of developed over time. But yeah, you'd have to talk to them.
All right. Great. All right. Thank you very much. That was very interesting.
Definitely. Thank you, guys.
We hope to welcome you again next time.
Cool. I appreciate it.
And good luck for all your entrepreneurial development.
Cool. It's exciting. It's stressful, but definitely exciting, too.
Yeah, and you're not an M&A type of entrepreneur, aren't you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you want to, like, you know, basically, I haven't had a lot of control over the business side of my business over the last few years. And maybe I'm a control freak, and so I want to have that control even though it's more work. So that's what I'm trying to figure out in part.
Maybe that's the reason why you have such a big impact in the industry. All right.
Yeah. Thank you, though.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Buzz.